You're listening to Sweat, Snot and Tears, brought to you by Netmums. I'm Annie O'Leary.
And I'm Wendy Gollidge. And together we talk about all of this week's sweaty, snotty and tearful parenting moments.
With guests who are far more interesting than we are. Welcome to the latest episode of Sweat, Snot and Tears, your weekly dose of all things parenting. This week we've got a slightly different format. Wendy can't be with us, sob. But in light of our special guest this week, I'm joined by a different co-host, my son, Atticus, who's 9. Say hi, Atty.
Hi.
Very good. And the reason we're joined by Atty is that this week's guest is author, beloved of 9-year-olds the world over. We've got Jeff Kinney, creator and author of the Wimpy Kid series. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Now, Jeff, we usually begin every episode by asking our guests whether there's been any sweat, snot, or tears in their household today so far. Tell us, which of the three have you had?
In my household today, boy, I only spent about 25 minutes with my kids awake and and me awake before I left. And so there wasn't any sweat, snot, or tears that I'm aware of. However, they are doing remote learning, so there may have been a few stifled tears.
Oh, that's hard. Is that because of COVID?
Yeah, so we're doing kind of a phased situation here where the kids are only going to school in person 2 days a week, and then they work from home the other 3 days. And we just started yesterday.
And how do you think it's going to go?
You know, I've been a little bit surprised this time around. We did this, of course, in the spring, and they did pretty well. But I think now it's much more regimented, and it's harder. And so the kids, they sit down at their desks at 7:30 in the morning, and they stay there until 2:30 with class after class after class. It's a little too much. You know, it's a little hard on them.
Yeah, it is. How old are they?
They are 15 and 17 years old.
Oh, wow. They're big kids.
Yeah, they're pretty big. Yep.
And they probably miss being with their friends.
I think they do. I think that, you know, we don't know what the psychological effects on kids are going to be, but this is a lost year. It's weird. You know, my oldest kid is a senior. He's a boy. And he is not, you know, doing the normal things that a senior should be doing. He's not going to parties or hanging out with his friends or, you know, going out for pizza. And, you know, boys and girls aren't mixing at all. So by the time he gets to college, an alien species too.
Are you finding that they're spending a lot more time chatting on the phone and on computers and stuff just so that they can stay connected?
No, I don't think that kids really chat on the phone the way that we did. You know, when I was my oldest son's age, 17, I spent hours on the phone each night with my girlfriend, with my friends who were male. And that is not a part of their culture. They will do everything to avoid actually having a conversation with somebody at the other end.
Yeah, like heaven forbid you should actually have to open your mouth.
Yeah, even, and they're not doing like FaceTime. I think they've got their fill of Zoom and all of that with their classroom situation. So not a lot of interaction that's similar to what I had as a kid.
Do you find that hard to relate to?
It is a little bit hard to relate to, but I kind of understand it. Like, take, for example, calling to get a pizza delivered. It's like, it's much easier to do that in an antiseptic sort of way through an app or something like this than to call somebody and, you know, read your credit card and have an actual interaction. So I can see why the kids, they find it just much more efficient to text or to communicate through a different form than voice.
Yeah, I guess we're just really old fashioned, aren't we?
Yeah, I guess so.
Voices are so last decade. Now, I've heard that you also, as well as writing your books, you run a bookshop. Is that true?
I do. I own a bookshop. I wouldn't say I run it, but I am involved. But I would be misrepresenting myself if I said I run the day-to-day operations. That being said, we have every week we have two or three pretty big guest authors that we have Zoom interviews with, and I'm always involved in those.
Who have you had recently?
We had Hillary Clinton, Kristen Bell, we had John Grisham, Neil Patrick Harris, lots of kid lit authors, Shannon Hale, and it's really cool. We're in this weird space where we can kind of get anyone, and it's not implausible to think that we could get Barack Obama, for example, as an author to do a virtual event with us. So it's been are really enriching in unusual situations.
It sounds like a dream come true to get to speak to all of your favorite authors. Now, I want to take you back to the beginning of the Wimpy Kid kind of era. Were you a parent when you first decided to write them, or did kids come afterwards?
I wasn't even married when I first started writing them. So I started when I was, I think, 27 or 28. That's when I had the idea for Diary of a Wimpy Kid. As I worked on it for 8 years, I had lots of life events happen, including finding a wife and then having two kids. So I think that by the time my first book came out, I had a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, if I'm doing my math correctly.
And once you had them, did they help inspire you more? Or did you see them as quite separate from the characters in your books?
I do see them as quite separate. My, you know, Greg Heffley is a kid who likes to read comic books and play lots of video games. And now my sons both like video games, but not in the way that I did, you know, as a child of the 80s with arcade games and things like that. But my boys are both athletes. They're both basketball players. That's a really big part of their lives. So they're different. And I don't get a lot of ideas directly from them. What I do get from them is a second crack at childhood where I'm able to stay young because I understand the language that they speak and the types of interactions that they have. So that's helped. And it's going to be really weird when they both move out and I'm just, I don't have a lot of exposure to young kids.
I'm sure there'll be kids queuing around the block to move in with you and help be your inspiration. Now, you make it look effortless. Your books are clearly, they strike a very true chord, a very authentic chord with kids of a certain age. Do you think that's because you're still a big kid at heart? Or do you have very specific memories of that time in your childhood? Why do you find that easy to do?
That's a great question. I do have specific memories of my childhood, so I really do remember what it's like to think like a kid. But I'm also, as a grown-up, I'm a flawed person. You know, I'm not a perfect person. I'm not always a role model. And so Greg Heffley is really a kid who's not, he doesn't have it all together. You know, he's not a hero character. And so a lot of my own thoughts get filtered through Greg Heffley. That makes it really kind of easy for me to write. You know, I'm just really writing myself.
Okay. Now, I think Atticus has a question for you that he'd like to ask at this point. Go ahead, Atti.
We know you based Greg on you, but who did you base Rowley on?
Yeah, you're right. Greg is based on me. Well, I had a best friend named Ryan, and there were some things that Ryan had in common with Rowley, but mostly they're very different. But we had a very good best friendship. You know, we did all those things together, like went down by the creek and had adventures and used our imagination, got into a little bit of trouble. So really, honestly, I'm just basing Rowley on the idea of having a best friend. And I was very lucky to have a best friend.
And are you still friends with Ryan now?
You know, we reconnected just recently. In the past 2 or 3 years, we reconnected after many years apart. And it was strange. Like, the last time I saw Ryan, he was probably a senior in high school. And he was so different physically. Like, I think he grew to like 6'5 or something like that. So he's a tall guy. And I wasn't used to that. Also, he had shaved his head bald. I wasn't used to that. And so in a lot of ways, he had changed so much. And I'm sure he thought the same thing of me.
And does he know that there's a strand of Rowley that's him?
Yeah, he does. In fact, I think he saw me on the Today Show or something like that, which is, our version of a morning show over here. And so I think that's when he first reconnected with me, because I was talking about something that we did when we tried to make a giant snowball and utterly failed. And so he caught wind of that and then reached out.
That's so lovely. Now, your style is comic, and as parents, we get anxious if our kids aren't wading through the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Should we be, or should we be just as happy for them to indulge their love of comic strips and comic books? Does it matter? As long as a kid is reading, is that what's important?
That's a great question. And I think every one of us as parents would love to see our kids reading really dense books, because it would mean that they're on their way, that they're elevated in some way. You know, and in fact, my son, when he was in about third or fourth grade, was tearing through the Harry Potter books. And I think parents get a little bit anxious when their kids seem to be reading things that have a lot of illustrations or seem graphic in some way, because I think some parents feel, you know, they question, is that reading? And I think that more and more we're finding that graphic reinforcement is really important for kids. And it helps inform the stories. It helps fill out the stories in a way. So I think it's a different type of literacy, but I think it's a very interesting and important form of literacy.
And which books do you like to see your readers graduate onto? If you could hand them on to another author when they're kind of, I don't know, when they've reached their teens, who would you most like to hand them on to?
That's a great question. I think Rick Riordan is a great author. I think he, you know, his books are full of adventure and they're very diverse in their representation. I think honestly, the way that I'm feeling these days is that diverse reading is the best type of reading. You know, especially in, you know, my country, the United States, there's this lack of empathy that comes from the top, and it's really hurting us. And books do this incredible service to us, which is it allows us to see life from another point of view.
Absolutely. You're so right.
Yeah. And so more and more, those are the types of books I've been reading. You know, I just read a book called Front Desk by an author named Kelly Yang, and she was a first generation Chinese American immigrant. And when she was 9 years old, she was basically running a motel with her family, running the front desk of the motel. And that's a story that I'm really glad that she wrote, because I hadn't had an experience like that. I was floored that such a young kid could have such a position of responsibility. And I'm better off for having read it, and everybody who's read it's better off for having read it. So I think that more of that, please, is the way that I feel.
I agree. Now, I've heard that you say that each of the books starts with you writing jokes and that you need at least 350 per book. Now, what I want to know is, how do you muster that level of creativity and humor when it's a boring Tuesday afternoon, you've had a row with your wife, your kids won't do the dishes, it's raining outside? How do you make yourself funny when you're not feeling funny?
That's a great question. So here's something to make it even less funny, is I do most of my joke writing at the cemetery.
Why?
Because with everybody in the house, it's impossible to write. So I'll drive my car to the cemetery on a cold day like today. I'll bring a blanket because I can't run the car all day. And then I go through this process. I use this process called systematic inventive thinking, which is kind of like a grind in a way. It's a way to very reliably be creative. And I'd be happy to tell you more about it if you're interested.
Yes, please tell us. Will it help all of us?
I think it will. So what I do first is I take a thing, like let's say I'm writing a book about airplane travel. So my first step is to take the thing, like the airplane, and I start by listing the parts, everything that's in the airplane. For example, the pilot, the seats, the wings, you know, are on the outside, of course, the bathroom, even the bag that you, you know, if you get sick, you've got on the plane. That's not a creative process, right? That's just listing. So far, so good. I'm about a third of the way there already. And then what I'll do is I'll start subtracting things, and I'll see if that gives me comedy. So for example, I might subtract seat, right? Like Greg's seat. And you think, okay, yeah, how could that be funny? If Greg doesn't have his seat, what does that look like? If Greg, is the seat physically missing? Has somebody sat in his seat? You know, eventually I'll get to a joke like that Greg gets up from his seat, uses the bathroom, the restroom, and then he comes back and there's a sleeping baby in his seat. What do you do if there's a sleeping baby and everybody else on the plane is asleep? You know, there's comedy there. And I got there in a really systematic sort of way. I didn't really need to use my imagination in a really active sort of way. I just kind of went through a process. And so I use about five tools of subtraction, division, multiplication, and some others. and I'll just grind all the way through all of the components, all of the pieces. And by the end of it, I'll have, these days, it's more like about 700 jokes at the end.
Oh, wow. Okay, maybe Atty, you can try using that tip with some of your creative writing homework. Now, I've seen that you were listed once as one of Time Magazine's top 100 influential people. How does that feel? Does it freak you out?
Well, that really mystified me because I had just started off on my path to becoming an author. I think I was like on, I don't even know if my third book was out yet. And so I wasn't, at that time, it was like, I had sold a few million books, which is awesome and incredible, but it definitely didn't feel appropriate for them to name me one of the most influential people. So I actually thought it was a joke. I thought it was a prank that somebody was pulling on me, and I tried to get to the bottom of it, and it kept coming out that it was legitimate. So that was really surprising and weird and funny, and it was great. It was really cool. And now I get to talk about it all these years later.
You'll be dining out on it forever. Right. Now, something that Atty and I were quite interested in when we were doing our research is that you say you were a complete computer games freak when you were younger, which I think is something Atty can relate to quite neatly. Can you give some hope to parents everywhere, including me, that screen time doesn't necessarily ruin young people's lives? How do you, or how have you managed screen time with your kids?
I can't give you that hope, unfortunately.
Please.
How have I managed it? It's, you know, the truth is that kids are managing us. It's not the other way around. Even if we think we are managing their screen time, they'll always find a way to subvert us. It's kind of funny because obviously, even as an adult, I'm bouncing from screen to screen to screen. You know, it's rare that I'm kind of off my screens because we always want to know what's happening. We always want to be in communication with other people. And we've got a computer in our pocket. You know, it's a weird time. At the same time, I think there are some kids who will step away from their screen and they'll create something and they'll do something that's not related to the screen. They'll learn a new skill. And I just feel like for those kids, I feel like while everybody else is paralyzed by their screens, there are going to be some kids who are going to be creators. And again, that's not to say that you can't create something on the screen. Of course, there's lots of great creators who create for the screen, for social media, for example. But especially during quarantine or these really unusual times, it's a really good opportunity to learn how to do something that other people can't do because most people are kind of paralyzed by screens. And I think that's advice I give to not just to kids, but to grownups as well.
Okay. And how about encouraging kids to read? Boys in particular aren't always the most eager bookworms. We do well because I think Atty's kind of hit on a formula that he likes. But how can parents who have sons who aren't really loving books make them fall in love with books?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that. From my perspective, I've had good success with getting kids to read because they, you know, because that's my life. That's how things have gone for me, is that I lucked out and wrote something that kids wanted to read. But I think the mistake we make sometimes as parents is to give our kids material that's a little too advanced for them or covers a subject matter that they're not really interested in, or we hand them books that worked for us as kids and they don't necessarily always translate into this generation. So I think that the best thing that we can possibly do as parents is to be really attuned to our kids' interests. Let's say Atty here was really interested in Pokemon, right? It might not be your interest, but it's his. And so you can get Pokemon magazines or find a site where it's like, you know, a forum or message board about Pokemon characters. You can, of course, get books. And so I think feeding your kids' interests is the most important way to get them going. And then once a kid understands that reading is a pleasurable act, once they get all the way through a book and close the last page, then I think there's a hope that they'll say, that was good. I feel edified. I feel satisfied. give me another one. I think that's, you know, that's the best that we can do, is to just listen to our kids. What are they interested in?
That's a good tip. Now, I think Atty wants to ask you something. Go ahead, Atty.
What were you good at and bad at school?
Good question. I would say I was good at art and I was good at English or reading. I think especially when I got to high school, chemistry and physics were just beyond me. So that's my answer, is I was good at the arts, basically.
He sounds like you, Atty. Maybe you could be him when you grow up. Is this what you thought you would be when you grew up? Is this what you wanted to do?
I wanted to be a newspaper cartoonist very badly. I wanted to be like Charles Schulz, who does Peanuts, and yes, Bill Watterson, who does Calvin and Hobbes. Like, it was easy for me to see my path. Like, I read the comics every morning, and I said, hopefully there's a slot for me. And unfortunately, that didn't work out for me. I tried for a few years to become a syndicated cartoonist. Nobody liked my work, and so I had to kind of do it a very different way. And so I kind of created a new type of medium, which is a real hybrid of text and comics. You know, it's a little bit different than an illustrated book, where it's,
yes,
you know, illustrations are different than comics. And so at the time, it was a kind of a novel format. And now there's lots of books like it, which I think is pretty cool.
And tell us about your childhood then. So you were this kid who was good at the arts, good at English, wanted to be a cartoonist. You liked computer games, but I've also read that you felt you were the odd one out between you and your siblings. How was that? How did that figure out?
You've done deep research. And by the way, sorry, we have two sound effects here. I'm sitting in my bookstore. We have sirens going by.
Oh, don't
and
worry.
I dropped my microphone.
Don't
so
worry,
sorry
that's
about
life.
This place really isn't as crime-ridden as it sounds right now. My siblings, yeah, I had two older siblings and one younger sibling, and it was either my fault or their fault that it was always me against all three of them. I think I kind of liked taking them on, and it really irritated them that I liked taking them on.
And are you close to them now?
I am. In fact, two of them, my older sister and my younger brother, both live on my street. And I think one day that my older brother might also live on my street. So I don't know how we did it or how we ended up on the right side of things, because it definitely didn't feel like that was even a possibility growing up. But
I'm sure.
Here we are. You know, we're going to do a fire pit tomorrow night. So that's what our life looks like now.
That's very nice. Now, I think part of your success is that you've kind of given tweens a voice. So that kind of awkward pre-adolescent phase where you're neither a little kid nor a teenager, and it feels like with you, they've got something they can identify with. I kind of touched on this earlier, but what were you like in that phase in your life? Why is that the phase you chose to write about?
In the US, they call that phase middle school or junior high, right? And so we have like a long period of time, K through six, which is kindergarten through sixth grade, which is a big swath. And then we have middle school, which is only 2 or 3 years. And then we have a 4-year high school experience, and of course, a 4-year college experience. And it really always felt to me like they were taking the kids in this kind of prepubescent or larval stage, right? When you're in that transition from going from a kid to an almost grown up. And it felt like they kind of segregated us in this school. They put us into this school, like almost to hide us in a way. And, you know, you go into that grade and there are literally kids, especially when you're 12 and 13 years old, there are some that have, you know, they're shaving, really and truly are shaving. And then there are some kids who are years away from shaving. And there are kids who are literally twice the sizes of other kids. And so it's a very angsty time. Sometimes you can feel kind of unsafe during that time, although I think things have really improved with this generation. But I felt very, very vulnerable at that time.
Oh, that's sad. Thinking of you as feeling scared and vulnerable. Now,
it's all right. I'm making money off of it now.
I think you turned it into a good thing. Now, what do you think about your parents' role in all of this? What do you think your parents got right in raising you? You're fabulously successful. You've brought joy to millions. You seem very solid and sane. Where did they get it so right?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm sure they'd appreciate you asking that.
Tell them I said hi.
I think my parents, they raised us to have good values. We also lived, we were kind of straight middle class. And we lived in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. My mother was an early childhood educator, got her PhD in that field. My father was a military analyst, worked at the Pentagon. I think that the greatest gift that my parents gave me was the gift of normalcy. Where we lived in the world was, we weren't in the rich neighborhood. We weren't in the neighborhood that wasn't as well off. To our south was kind of almost like a wild country, that totally different types of people. And it was a really busy and congested place to live. So we were really in the middle of it all. And I felt like from my perch, I got to observe a lot. I got a little bit of a taste of everything. And so I don't feel like I had a really specific experience. I had an experience that was, sort of very well-rounded. So I think that in that way, that's what helped make me the person or the writer that I am, is that I sort of lucked out having this very average experience.
And obviously now you're a parent, though your sons are kind of getting older. What advice would you give to parents who are kind of facing the kind of what we call the coal face of those earlier years, where it's hard and you're getting no sleep and you wonder why the hell you had these kids? What advice would you give to parents facing that stage?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I would dial it back a little bit. Like I have a coworker here who actually relocated from London, and she came over with, I think it was a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. And I said to her, this is the hardest stage. You've got two kids who are in, diapers, and and you really need to be on top of them all the time. And it's like, it's going to get easier and easier. So I felt like, to me, that was the hardest phase. This stage that we're in right now feels really good to me, because I can have good, deep conversations with my kids. And I just feel like there's not enough time. My son's almost on to university, and this was never the plan. I wanted them to be kids forever. Yeah. So I feel sort of sad about it.
And in particular, I was going to ask, what advice would you give to dads? The role of a dad feels like it's really changed a lot in our lifetime. What advice would you give dad to dad?
Well, I wish, if I was the ultimate dad, I could, tell everybody what I think they should do. But I'm trying to figure it out just like everybody else. I'm sure I've made mistakes along the way. I would say the best advice I can give to dads that I do know is true is to be able to use words, I understand, because most of what your kids will go through, you have gone through yourselves. And so I think sometimes, because you have so much separation from your childhood, it's easy to forget that you've made some mistakes and have had some feelings that you'd be sort of ashamed to have now. But I think the more that we can tell our kids that we understand them and can relate to what they're going through, the better bridge we can build to our kids.
And what about to parents of boys in particular, seeing as that's your experience? What do you think is the most important thing when trying to relate to your child who is a boy?
I think that the most important thing we can teach our boys is how to be moral and empathetic. We've seen, especially in the past few years, it really come to light how, boys, if they're not taught how to treat women, for example, they can make some big mistakes later on in their life. And it's so important for boys to understand how sacred women are. And how we should always treat everybody with respect. And I think that it's really important to try to look at other people's lives and try to be empathetic towards other people's situations that are dissimilar to yours.
That's very good advice. Now, Atti, you've got one last question to ask, haven't you? Do you want to ask it now?
When is your next book coming?
Poor Atti has been waiting this whole time as we talk about boring stuff about parenting.
And that's all he really wants to know is, can you hurry up and write another one, please? Because he just got the new one for his birthday, but he read it in about a day.
The new Diary of a Wimpy Kid book comes out, I believe, October 27th over there. Definitely over here, it's October 27th. And it's called The Deep End. And it's kind of a mix of two things. It's a mix of quarantine living and escapism, like the thing that we really want to do right now, which is get away from our current situation. So it's a camping book, and the family goes on on a camping holiday, which is really kind of fun.
And that's what we're doing next week. So it's perfect for us. There we go. Now, last two questions. First of all, Jeff Kinney, how do you want to be remembered?
The only thing I want to be remembered for is being a good dad. That's the only thing that I really care about. And everything else is just garnishing, I guess you could say.
The cherry on the cake.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the last question, we always ask this of our guests each week. If you were tucking us into bed right now, what would you sing to us or read to us or say to us? What would your bedtime ritual be with your kids?
Oh boy, that's a good question. You know, I'm going to be very honest with you, is that, you know, we haven't put our kids to bed in a really long time.
I'm sure they're big boys now.
But we always actually ended with a prayer. You know, we basically ask for, you know, sort of protection and name all the people that we love. And I think there was something really rhythmic about that. And I think that my kids have carried that on without our guidance. So, you know, it's especially during these times, especially in my country, it's a scary time. You know, I don't think it hurts to be prayerful, honestly, in these times.
Well, that's a lovely note to end on. Jeff Kinney, thank you so much. Atticus, did you want to say thank you as well?
Thank you.
Thank you, Atticus. I appreciate it. Great questions.
And thank you for all the joy you've brought him with your books. I can't thank you enough.
That.
It's amazing.
Thanks so much.
All right. Have a great day, Jeff.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.